Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as a minister of this congregation. I'm delighted to be joined in welcoming you this morning by one of our newest worship associates, Lisa Teal, our interim director of religious education, Karen Labracco, and our music director, Hal Walker. We're always also so pleased to have two among us singing in our service today. We have beautiful music in store. Often the simple act of lighting a candle is an act of hope. And so we light our chalice this morning with hope that the hour before us will provide us with the opportunity to remember our priorities and center ourselves so that we might live this day and the week before us in the light of the love and peace and justice we seek.
Not wanting. The five colors blind our eyes. The five notes deafen our ears. The five flavors dull our taste. Racing, chasing, hunting drives people crazy. Trying to get rich ties people in knots. So the wise soul watches with the inner, not the outward eye. Letting that go, keeping this.
Last week, when we were surrounded by snow, I started making plans for my summer vacation. And I and my family will be returning to Beaver Lake, a little place where I learned how to fish, my children learned how to fish, and we're hoping to invite the grandchildren to learn how to fish. So naturally, I started thinking about fishing. And a story, probably there was a fisherman, probably someplace like Beaver Lake. It was probably a summer afternoon. The fisherman had finished for the work of the day and was enjoying the beautiful water, probably sitting back, probably with some grass, maybe chewing that blade of grass, enjoying it, when a stranger came. This was a man who was probably one of those highfalutin Wall Street financier kinds of people, and said, "Hey, why aren't you fishing?" "Well, I've caught enough for the day." "Enough for the day? Why, if you went out again, you could get more fish." "Why would I want to do that?" "Well, so you could sell the fish and get more money." "What would I need the money for?" "Well, if you had more money, then you could go and maybe buy a motor for your boat. And then you could go in deeper water. And if you went in deeper water, you could catch more fish. And if you caught more fish, you would have more money. And then, if you had more money, you could buy one of those fancy-dancy nylon nets, and you could catch more fish. And if you caught more fish, then you'd have more money, and you could buy another boat. And maybe even a whole fleet of boats. And then you would be rich like me." "And if I was rich like you, then what would I do?" "Well, if you were rich like me, then you could enjoy life." I think that's what I've been doing.
To lead us into a time of prayer and meditation, these wisdom words from Rumi. In every breath, if you're the center of your own desires, you'll lose the grace of your beloved. But if in every breath you blow away your self-claim, the ecstasy of love will soon arrive. In every breath, if you are the center of your own thoughts, the sadness of autumn will fall on you. But if in every breath you strip naked, just like a winter, the joy of spring will grow from within. All your impatience comes from the push for gain of patience. Let go of the effort, and peace will arrive. All your unfulfilled desires are from your greed for gain of fulfillments. Let go of them all, and they will be sent as gifts. Fall in love with the agony of love, not the ecstasy. Then the beloved will fall in love with you. And now, surrounded by the sounds of our community, we in this space will sit together in a few moments of stillness. You join with me in the spirit of prayer. O you, thou known to us by so many names, love, justice, beloved community, you known to us, Gaia, God, spirit of wonder, you known to us only in glimpses, beloved mystery. We gather this morning with hopes of remembering that there is something more. Something more than our own thoughts, our own wishes, our own desires, our own striving. And so we pray to you, known to us by a thousand names, you whom we forget, disavow, sometimes remember. May we remember you in this moment and remember that there is something more to which we can hitch our star, something more to which we can pledge our hearts and devote the work of our lives. May we remember this morning that it isn't foolish to hope. Help us be the evidence to the contrary. Help us see the evidence to the contrary. And lend our voices, our hands, our hearts to the establishment of peace. Amen. Krishna Fitch is sharing a song from her spiritual path with us today. She provided a translation of the song, which is an insert in your order of service, as well as this context. She writes that bhakti is love and devotion. Bhakti desire is said to be the constant companion of the soul, and therefore you cannot extinguish it. However, by acquiring a higher taste, desire can be the mode of transcendence. By directing our desire to communion with the divine, our material desires are automatically lessened or even lost because the intensity of our natural love for God is ever increasing. As can be seen in this song, she explains, there is a desperate desire for the beloved Lord, and that is the perfect meditation. It's natural, like a young couple in love, always thinking of one another without effort while they're going about their day, doing their work. Their consciousness is absorbed in that love. That is bhakti, to feel that love for the Lord constantly. you, Krishna. That song really helps bridge the service last week with the one this week, because they're really connected. Though if you weren't here, this will stand on its own too. Just as a little reminder or recap for those who weren't here, last week was all about celebrating desire, because desire is normal, desire is natural, desire is a gift that can bring joy, pleasure, wholeness, even holiness into our lives. So last week we celebrated desire, and this week we acknowledge that, as in so many things, there are two sides of a coin. And it's true that desire can also get us into trouble. Far from appearing as a gift, sometimes desire can seem to us to be a curse. The word insatiable means impossible to satisfy. And we chose that word to evoke this sense that desire can sometimes feel desperate, like an obsession. Addiction can be like that. Addiction runs in my family of origin, and I have seen too closely and too clearly the ways that the insatiable desire for drugs can tear apart people's lives, their livelihoods, their families, leave them with nothing. Addiction of all kinds can have the same powerfully destructive force. Whatever the addiction, the desire to satisfy it generally masks other deeper desires, which is part of the why the work of getting free can sometimes be so emotionally and spiritually demanding. Even when a person has untangled the threads enough to understand themselves and their condition more clearly, even when they have done that, the internal struggle between the desire for whatever is the object of the addiction and the desire to get free of that thing cannot be underestimated. If addiction has been a part of your life or the life of someone you love, then this is probably the clearest example of the sometimes destructive force of desire. But there are others. Infidelity is another example. It's a common experience. Just how common is difficult to say. The statistics about how prevalent infidelity is vary wildly. I read 10% and 70%, and many numbers in between. Part of the reason this is so difficult to assess is, of course, many people do not want to admit when they're engaged in extramarital affairs. But the numbers of people who do admit that they engage in an extramarital affair, married people who admit to cheating, are about 10% a year. So that's a minimum number. The reasons people engage in emotional or sexual affairs outside of a relationship that they have named as monogamous can vary from person to person. What they have in common is the desire for something more or something different from that which they already experience, and the choice to risk the potential consequences in order to fulfill that desire. The person having the affair pays a price for following their desire, whether or not the affair ever becomes known. People who have found themselves in this circumstance have told me that the price can be as great as their own peace of mind. And if the affair does become known, the price can also include the shattering of peace in their primary relationship. So addiction and infidelity are two big examples of the ways the lure of desire can harm relationships and undermine our spiritual well-being. And I name them because I know that they have touched the lives of people in this congregation. And it would be, I think, irresponsible not to acknowledge that some sitting in this room today have been wounded by desire in some pretty significant ways. So if that includes you, I want you to know that I'm happy to speak with you about this further privately or provide referrals for additional support if that might be necessary. And if that doesn't include you, if that's not a part of the reality of your life, no doubt you can still think of ways that desire has stressed your relationships with other people, romantic or not, and left you feeling unsettled. I'm thinking about the time years ago that my girlfriend at the time was having an opening of an exhibit that she had worked on for a long time, worked really hard, and I was supposed to go but didn't show up until it was almost over because I chose to stay late at work. It's not a terribly sexy desire. But it is true. I didn't have the kind of job where I had to stay late at work, though I probably spun it that way in defense when I realized she was mad. The truth is, I stayed late at work because my own desire is toward a kind of perfectionism that is unattainable, and it shows up in so many places in my life, including at work. And so I have struggled sometimes with putting work first when it shouldn't have been first. And I'm sure I didn't think about that choice too much in the moment of that decision, but I sure wish I had afterward. One of the troubles with desire is the way it can lead us to confusion about our priorities. So, what are we to do about troubling desire? One ancient response that many spiritual seekers have practiced is the path of renunciation. You're probably familiar with the way of the ascetic. The word ascetic means someone who practices an extreme form of self-denial, often involving some kind of cloistering or sequestering in a temple or a monastery or in a cave in the mountains or deep in the woods. The devout who follow this path strive to deal with troubling desire by removing themselves from the source of temptation. By removing the temptations of worldly desires, these seekers hope to focus all of their energies on desire for transcendence or union with whatever the highest spiritual quest is named in their tradition. Mark Epstein is a psychotherapist and a well-regarded Buddhist teacher and author. And he thinks that there is a place for the path of the ascetic in our contemporary life, that renunciation can be helpful for a time. And he says it can be especially helpful for people who are struggling with addiction or some kind of obsession. However, he also acknowledges that there are limitations to the approach of renunciation. Renunciation can work when a person is isolated from temptation, but what happens when we go back to trying to live an ordinary life where temptation abounds? He argues that another path to wholeness and spiritual freedom can be found in learning what desire has to teach instead of trying to turn away from it. He calls his book Open to Desire, and he begins with a parable about the wise fool Nasruddin. There are lots and lots of parables from the 13th century about Nasruddin from the Middle East. Nasruddin is sitting in the middle of a marketplace. He's crying his eyes out, and he has a platter of peppers in front of him. And steadily and methodically, he reaches for pepper after pepper and pops it into his mouth, chewing deliberately, all the while wailing. What's wrong, Nasruddin? His friends wonder, watching this extraordinary sight. What is the matter with you? Tears stream down Nasruddin's face as he pops another pepper in and sputters an answer, "I'm looking for a sweet one." The story reveals the pain of desire right next to the pleasure of desire. Even when the peppers are hot, we can't stop tasting them because we know that there's a sweet one in there. And the pleasure often feels worth the pain. Epstein argues that desire is a normal and natural part of the human condition. And so rather than trying to suppress it, removing that plate of peppers so we can't see them, he says, instead, let's get curious about it and learn how to let our desire inform the good that we seek. These are his words. There's a yearning in desire that is as spiritual as it is sensual. Even when it degenerates into addiction, there's something salvageable from the original impulse that can only be described as sacred. Something in the person wants to be free, and it seeks its freedom any way it can. In the introduction to her song, Krishna explained that by acquiring a higher taste, transcendence, desire can be a mode of transcendence. Likewise, Epstein says that by becoming curious about the energy underneath our desires, we can learn how to use that energy instead of being used by it. We can learn how to use the energy of our desires instead of being used by the energy of our desires. The problem, he says, isn't desire, but clinging to our desires. And this is good news. Desire may sometimes get us into trouble, but if we learn to be curious about it and open to the impulse behind our desires, That may be a path to lead us out of the trouble. By loosening our grip and our judgment, we can be curious enough to learn what is underneath our desires, and then we might find that there's something at the core that can be harnessed to help lead us to the peace and freedom we all want. Though this counsel comes from a very different tradition, it shares some similarities with the Jesuit approach to the theology of desire that I talked about last week. There's a Jesuit prayer practice that is intended to be done over a series of days about desire. And it begins by interrogating desire, by asking, what is it that you want? What do you want? Asking yourself, what do I want? And then, after some time has passed, what do I really want? And then a third time, after some time has passed, what do I really, really want? A Jesuit young adult who did this prayer practice explains that it can lead us to discover the holy impulse underneath desires that even seem like unholy longings on the surface. So take jealousy at other people's financial circumstances as an example. Seeing others have the money for fancy houses and nice cars and interesting vacations can make many of us desire to have that for ourselves. Wanting to be rich is the surface desire. It doesn't seem particularly noble, but the practice invites us to set aside judgment, whatever our judgment is about that impulse in us, the desire to be rich, and instead be curious about it. What is behind that impulse? What do you really want? Well, maybe once we sit with the question, we might find that what we really want is enough money to live a comfortable life. And who doesn't want that? But there's more. If we sit with it a little longer and interrogate even further, what is it we really, really want, we may find that there's something deeper still. So in this example, we might find, if we interrogate further, that what we really, really want is enough money to live a comfortable life for ourselves and enough to be generous with others. What seemed like a selfish desire may, if we dig deep enough, have an impulse underneath it that is something to pay attention to. Taking the time to look closely at our desires to find the holy longing within can be life-changing. So if you think your desire is to be rich, you will live one way. But if you think your deepest desire, if you realize that your deepest desire is to be generous, you will make very different choices. Every day we're making choices. So many of them fueled by our surface desires, that initial impulse, I want. If there is any area of your life that feels out of balance on accord of your wanting, perhaps a clear and honest examination of your desire and the ways that they are driving you can help you find your way back to center.
I'm going to read a few sentences, and I would like you to mentally fill in the blanks. And you can be honest, because only you will hear the response. I will be happy when blank. I know that things will be perfect if only blank. If I could just blank, everything would surely fall into place. If my spouse, child, parent could just blank, things would be so great. How many times have you thought such thoughts? If you're a human being, chances are pretty good you've done it many times. I don't think I'm an exception, but I've noticed a few flaws. If blank above is a reachable goal, when we arrive there, invariably a new blank pops up in its place. And if we get there, the blank often isn't what it's cracked up to be. It rarely lives up to the anticipation, or it doesn't last long, and we quickly find ourselves back in the wanting stage. Also, as John Lennon wrote, life is what happens when we're busy making other plans. If we spend our lives in this what-if or if-only state, we overlook a lot. Desiring keeps our focus on the lack and prevents us from noticing what is all around us, the glory, the beauty of every day. It keeps us from the present moment, and the present moment is where some say that God lives. It's the only place we can find the divine. And perhaps the most important flaw, desire is the opposite of contentment. They cannot coexist. So when we're in a state of desire, we are unable to experience a sense of wholeness, which is really our birthright, our most natural state to which we are always yearning to return. So what is enough? What does enough even look like? In the ancient Hindu text, the Ramayana, desire is depicted as a voracious 10-headed demon named Ravana, which I think is a source for the word ravenous. So with 10 heads, Ravana can never be sated. So for a more modern-day example, spend an hour watching commercial television and we'll see we're never good enough and the perfect solution's just around the corner. I think contentment in our culture is very difficult. Yoga philosophy teaches the concepts of raga and dvesha, or attraction and repulsion. And they're very much related and are, in fact, two sides of the same coin. If we have an attraction to something, we usually have an aversion to the opposite, even if it's just losing that thing once we obtain it. I'm sure you can easily insert your own examples there. So without attention or self-study, we're tossed about by these two driving forces without any idea of what's happening. We're tossed between trying to get what we want and avoid what we don't want, whether it's a thing or a feeling or anything. But when we talk about contentment, we should differentiate it from complacency or apathy. As a UU congregation, we strive for social justice. And as practitioners and human beings, we should want to improve ourselves. As parents, we want our kids to raise the bar for themselves. Desiring change and growth in the betterment of society and ourselves is a good thing. But how do we balance wanting with acceptance and contentment? What I find helps me in my own practice is what I call a process of discernment. So first, I have to notice, to become aware. This seems really simple, but so much happens under the radar. We unconsciously reach for things and solutions all the time without any idea that it's happening, perhaps in an effort to make an uncomfortable feeling of lack just go away quickly. I'm working on simply acknowledging that I'm craving something and then to allow that feeling, to witness it, just to admit that desire is there. Then I'll try and sense.